So we're back after lunch, and before lunch, you were mentioning something about the International Journal of Mass Spec and how you had first. Did you know Harry Speck before?
No.
You had this experience with him.
No.
And he was the editor.
Yes.
So you ended up sending papers in for to the International Journal. And discovered that they came back rather quickly, even though there was no electronic communication.
Yes.
And basically, you just figured out pretty much that he was doing the whole business by himself.
I don't think he did that for everything that we published. This was the only one that was noticeable, and the others came back with, you know, referees or reviewers' comments, but not too sure that it was Harry or not. But they just had a good way of doing business. Uh-huh. And I liked them.
And what particularly did you like? Just the bad rapid return?
Fairness.
Ah.
Sometimes you get guidance on the reviewer's comments.
Uh-huh.
You know, this is perhaps reasonable, but it's not terribly important. You can skip this part.
Okay.
So you have some guidance as to how you might deal with it. So I was really pleased to get this, and I've been a member of the board for a long time, advisory board,
okay.
Editorial board, for a long time. So.
So I guess everyone has had this rejection problem in their life. I think most people have. Have you had a that nice letter you get back from the editor saying we don't think you should publish this in this journal or anything quite that?
Until about 3 years ago, very, very seldom. I couldn't remember the last time I had a paper refused. In fact, I don't think I've ever had a paper refused. No, I think I did in the very late 1960s, Chemical Journal of Canada had one. But I got one from Joe Liu, and I was incensed and sent him a response of 19 points where he and the two reviewers had been in error.
Oh, wow.
But he wouldn't countenance any appeal. It's interesting because, and the battle goes on. But I had a victory in a way. And the battle goes on because you have a protein of N+,
okay,
charges, positive charges, let us say, plus something like ibuprofen. We know that proteins carry medications, and drugs, so that this would give us a protein, N+, and ibuprofen. Ibu is a non-covalently bonded complex.
Sure.
And Joe Liu said this should be protein N-1. Plus, because this adds as an anion, a negatively charged ion.
Okay.
And we said, well, this is the same peak. I mean, N is the plus. Mass spectrometrically, if you have a series of peaks and like that, and then they go to that and that and that, all moving along just a little bit.
Yeah.
There's no change in the relative proportions. They're adding as neutral molecules. He wouldn't accept that. He still doesn't.
No way.
Still doesn't. And then he sent me a paper. A Chinese fellow had sent in some polybrominated diphenyl ethers.
Okay.
And he'd made up 26 or 27 of these and found only 3 reacted with BSA. BSA is the same process of multiply charged protein, and the most prevalent state or the base peak for this would be 17+. And he added these things, found that 3 types of these polybrominated compounds added. And then he showed the spectra. And that was it. Uh-huh. And Joe sent me this paper. And I said, well, the author must explain the results to some extent. And I sent it back, and I made some sketch, and sent it back, and waited. Nothing happened. So I phoned up to ask. No, the paper had been rejected. Hmm. I was never told, but it had been rejected. I was incensed once more.
Yeah.
Just that wasn't what I... I had given some clues to the author. So I had the address and so on, so I emailed the author and said, I'm awfully sorry, I was reviewing this thing. He said, I was asked for an opinion. And I said, my opinion was such and such, so I've expanded upon my results. And here, I think, is the explanation for your thing. And it can be all summed up in reactions 1, 2, 3, and 4. The mechanism. That's it. There we are. I suggest, if you're interested, you send this to the IGMS and tell them that I have recommended. I don't want to be an author, but that I've recommended this. So they did that, and it was accepted as being published. And the beauty is, there are two mechanisms for these things. One is the addition of a neutral, mm-hmm. so there's no change in it. And the other is the addition of an anion. Mm-hmm. Both occur. So this now peak now comes in here. So if you look at the relative intensities of these, you can work it all backwards beautifully. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There we are. have some fun with the the editors. Yes.
So that wasn't submitted. Is Lou on the editorial board of the Canadian?
Jasmus.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Unfairly so, I thought. And I had got on well with Joe. Is this on?
Yeah.
I was appointed to. He says asked to sit on an ad hoc committee. Following the ASMS meeting in Chicago, around about 2001, in fact, I think.
I don't remember. I didn't find out.
It was the same year as 9/11.
Oh.
2001. So it was May, June 2001. Went to Chicago. Mm-hmm. Chicago was beautiful, but we had too many people. We had escalators up and down, and people were coming out of lectures, two or three lectures. It was our lectures are simultaneously timetabled, and so there were lots of people moving in restricted areas.
Yeah.
And I thought there was a problem, a real problem with that. I didn't say anything, but I was asked to go on this committee to deal with the success of the society. And I said, I really don't think I should, because I have never really had much association with successful institutions. And anyway, I got on it, and we met in Denver. That was September.
Uh-huh.
Late September, following
9/11.
Uh-huh. The huge hotel lobby was empty, mm. apart from a clerk and a waitress in the food area. Mm. It was scary.
Yeah.
I got checked in, and then met up, and we had our committee. And only about half the committee was staying there. The other half were, local, mm-hmm. from Boulder or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
What's her name was on it? Veronica.
Veronica Beerbaum.
And Joe Liu. So we had our meeting, and then that evening we went out to dinner, and I asked him, where were you on when you couldn't get back from? He was in London,
uh-huh.
and he couldn't get back, so I said, well, what did you do? He said, well, I went to the Science Museum. I said, of course, why didn't I know that?
Yeah.
So he told me, told us, that he had seen what is supposedly Aston's second mass spectrometer,
mm-hmm.
and that this was on show and so on. So we had the idea of perhaps trying to persuade the science British Science Museum to rent it out to ASMS mm-hmm. so that we could show it. Well, we thought that was a good idea, so we corresponded, and eventually I was in England and I spoke to Keith Jennings mm-hmm. and he said, well, why don't you go? I was in England, so he said, why don't you go to Cambridge mm-hmm. and ask me. He said, here's, I know Gordon's somebody, ask Gordon, he's the curator or something of the museum that they have there. So I made an appointment, went to see Gordon, and they agreed to make the same workshop facsimiles mm-hmm. of about four instruments. Mm-hmm. So I went back and gave an estimate of about $25,000 to make them and have them transported to USA, and it went to the board, and the board approved it. Mm. And that's what we have. Mm. Those are still available to ASMS. They belong to ASMS, and they've been shown at some conferences. Mm. And that all came from that discussion between Jean-Louis and I at that conference. Yes. Mm.
Interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
So, what did you decide other about the success of ASMS and what to do about it?
Oh, we that one was interesting. We said there should be physically larger facilities. It's useless trying to get 5,000 people into something that's only fit for three. Mm. And there are fire regulations for these things. Also, you can't just put people sitting on the floor and standing in the aisles, etc. That's just inviting trouble, and it's foolish and not a good example to set. So then somebody had mentioned the idea of televising it locally in the hotel. So that evening, I telephoned the hotel where we were going to be in 2002 and asked them if did they have such facilities, if we wanted to do this. Had a good discussion with the person there, even though it was Saturday night. I think it was a slow time. Mm-hmm. And yes, they could do this. Put on, and they would put cameras in, and they could record, and they could broadcast later, simultaneously and later, they could do all of this. So I went back to the meeting and told them this the next day. Well, what's her name? The executive director.
Judith. Schoberg.
Ex-wife of Jack
Watson.
Was furious. Just, how dare you phone the hotel? I said, because, madam, I am a Canadian and I am free to telephone any hotel that I wish in this country or in any other. I was really annoyed with her because she took after me and she shouldn't have done. So that passed a little. But I wasn't giving an inch. Mm-hmm. I've got information, we could do this, and in fact we ended up doing that. Yeah. And each conference since that time has had a television link, so you can stay in bed and listen to the 8:15 lecture while you're drinking your coffee and orange juice, etc. Yes.
Yeah. Interesting.
There's some good things came from that meeting, because holding a meeting for I think there were nearly over 6,000 people in Baltimore, as reported at the annual meeting. On the Thursday, I think it was, and managing that number of people well and safely, it takes a lot of skill and knowledge. Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. 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 So it was important.
So there were some ideas that came out of their ad hoc committee that were adopted.
Yes.
I think ASMS is open to ideas to help it, continue to be viable.
Yes. Well, I'm hoping, because I went on Thursday this year, I went in Baltimore, I went to a workshop. I rarely go to the workshops because I don't think they work terribly well. Anyway, I went to the workshop. It was entitled something like, "Is the time of the quadrupole iron trap past?" So I thought, oh, I'm going to go. This will be great entertainment. So I had a free beer at the business meeting and then went to this workshop afterwards. Well, I was horrified. there was a little presentation by three people, which was really not very much at all, and then comments and questions. People were just asking questions about, they wanted to know about, is this mass range and the frequencies here and this, and what about the diagram, and have we done this with traps? They just want to know knowledge, experimental knowledge about the traps. So eventually I got up and said, no, John Todd and I have produced 7 iron trap books. We didn't just do it for fun. We did it to try to tell everyone about iron traps, not just our work, but about 36 laboratories contributed. And we didn't just take their papers. I mean, there are some compendiums, like the first one by Rafferty, no, McLafferty. He published Tandem Mass Spectrometry. It's dreadful.
McLafferty?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
The font is different for the various chapters. Yeah. There are mistakes. I mean, they just simply put 10 chapters together and published it. I said, each chapter here has been scrutinized and edited by both of us until we agree, so that they're readily comprehensible and the style is consistent throughout the entire book. And I said, and clearly, not too many people here have availed themselves of that opportunity. Could I ask, how many people have read John Syker? And John Syker was sitting there. John Syker. And here is John. How many people have read his chapter on the commercialization of the iron trap? I said, it's a fascinating story. How many people have? 8. Uh-huh. Of which I was one, John was one, and Rick from Florida. Rick Yost was another. So there are only 5 non-people associated with the book who had read the damn chapter. I said, let me ask you one more question. Vern Reinhardt wrote an absolutely splendid chapter on using MS to the 7th to determine the structure of sugar complexes. Mm-hmm. How many people have read that? 3. Mm-hmm. Rick, myself, and one other guy I didn't know. Now, I'd heard at the meeting that in the war chest of ASMS, there was $2 million sitting there. And so I wrote to Jennifer. Jennifer and I wrote a book on mass spectrometry and NMR, a paper, but a long one, some time ago. And she has contributed at least 3 chapters to these books.
This is Broadbelt.
Jennifer Broadbelt, who is now president. Posing a question, should we? Can we not approach the publishers and attempt to get a much better deal? Perhaps, what's the word I'm looking for? ASMS supporting it with funds. What's the word? Underwriting or something, but contributing anyway to the overall cost of the
work,
to make these publications more available to our membership. Mm-hmm. So I sent it off to her. There was 2 people. There's one is publications, one is education. So I sent it to the 3 of them, and Jennifer said it's under consideration. So
this is John Sykes. That you were talking about, I didn't get how to spell his last name.
John S. or Sykes, Sykes.
Oh, okay.
It's the, I keep forgetting all my names. Who was the guy who wrote about Oliver Twist?
That's too big a leap for me.
Oliver Twist. The villain in Oliver Twist was somebody called Sykes. Mm. Bill Sykes. Mm. Bill Sykes was these. So I've got the 7 books behind you, plus one in Portuguese.
Yeah.
And John Sykes' chapter's there, and Vince's, and Vern's there. But it is a real shame that they have...
Basically, you're saying that the workshop where people were trying to learn, it wasn't the equals talking about experiments, it was and trying to help each other along. It was more or less people who hadn't used traps wanting to learn about them.
Or perhaps had one and wanted to know more about trying to understand it more.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, maybe you got some book sales out of it.
Maybe. A few. A few wasn't the objective.
Yeah.
The first book was written really to say, Peter Dawson's book exists, and it is it's there. It's not easy for the novice to understand. The chapters are all different by different sets of authors, and no attempt has been made to bring them into a coherent book. They have different styles and so on. But here is one that covers the material of Dawson's book, and since, because Dawson's book was published in 74, I think, and ours came out in 89, but cover the work since, and the arrival of the first commercial instruments, and so introducing them, and what work has been done by others in this field, on atomic clocks, for example, or in France. And so it was really... quite a nice book, and it was well received, and that was successful. But it's not being picked up by newcomers. We know from the sales that it's not being picked up. Mm-hmm. It's being reprinted, but it's not being picked up by newcomers coming in. And we discussed quadrupole iron traps plus the quadrupole rod sets acting as linear iron traps, as quadrupole mass filters, and as transmissions rods, because they really pinch in the beam of ions so that you can get the ions through a much smaller hole, which reduces the pumping requirements, which decreases the cost and improves the sensitivity. I mean, they're all linked. And then you have Matthew's diagrams, stability diagrams, which were a real problem for people in mass spectrometry, teaching mass spectrometry, who were 40 or older when the iron traps first came out. Mm-hmm. That's about 1970, 72. Mm-hmm. Only Graham Cooks, as being a fairly well-established mass spectrometer, made an attempt to be. All of the other people, whether that's Rick or McCluckey, or who was McCluckey's friend, Gary?
Yeah, Glish.
Glish. They were all younger, you see. Mm-hmm. And so they took to it like a fish to a duck to water. And the stability diagram was no challenge. But that stability diagram, you know the one I mean, this one?
Yes.
Yes. That was an activation energy towards the understanding of quadrupole for a huge number of mass spectrometrists. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Anyone who was born 1930 or before, it's true. Mm-hmm. Yes, and some even after.
Yeah.
Yes, it was totally different from transmission through magnetic and electrostatic sectors.
Yeah.
It was a little like ICR. Mm-hmm. There were some great similarities, the frequency, etc., with ICR, but that was relatively few people. There were a few people in France, Rose Marx, and then there were people in the States who had ICR. I used to always be at the end of the ICR session. One possibly two talks on quadrupole iron trap at the end of that session. So I know a lot about ICR. Who did the first Fourier transform? It was the guy who was down in Florida now, and they were both at UBC. It's gone. They were both at UBC at the time, but he was a Canadian who used to do ICR. Anyway, that's the end of that.
So I need to back up to...
Yes.
Let's go back to the beginnings of Trent. you had duties in the teaching end of the world, right?
Yes.
Did you have any duties in that regard when you were at McGill?
Yes. Yes, I started out because Schiff, two things had happened to Schiff. One, he had accepted an appointment 2 years before I left as Dean of York University, which is north of Toronto, by the airport.
Okay.
So he was at McGill, and he accepted this position at the new campus of York University. Mm-hmm. And so he would spend, you know, 1 week there, 1 week at McGill, oh, wow, travel back and forth, all sorts of combinations.
Yeah.
And then, so that went on for quite some time. And then in the winter, he broke his leg skiing.
Uh-oh.
So I got a call one Sunday night. Ray, I have a lecture, the such and such tomorrow. It's chemistry 200 and something. They're doing this. Can you stand in for me? About 300 students.
Oh, yeah.
Now, fortunately, I had been asked to do an evening class at Loyola University. Oh. Loyola College, sorry, it's part of a bigger university now. Loyola College in Montreal was a religious institution.
Sounds Jesuit.
Yes, it no longer exists as such. It's part of, it begins with a C, I've forgotten the name. But I was asked if I would do that, and these were people who were really keen, about a dozen, 18 perhaps, and it was a great joy teaching them physical chemistry. So yes. I was doing that. I wasn't without any teaching skills at all. So I started lecturing the class, and so of course his leg, didn't repair itself in a few days.
Yeah,
he had the damn thing in it. And for several weeks, 6 or 7 weeks. So I had that experience of teaching.
But
yes.
You were called in to cover for him, but did you have any requirements to teach?
No.
Independently?
No.
Okay.
No. So other than Loyola, no.
Okay. But you did have one, you got to Trent.
Oh, yes.
You were required to be a faculty teacher as a... So, is there physical chemistry or organic?
First year chemistry, because we only had them my first year, first and second year. So, I did part of first year chemistry, and then we had a second year physical, and I was developing and constructing the experiments for this course. That takes some time doing, but it was all exciting stuff.
Class size at Trent when you started out was how big?
Oh, well, the first year chemistry would be about 40, and the physical chemistry perhaps no more than half of that.
I guess most of the kids would be local. For starting up, it's a bit of a risk for the kid too to go to a startup school like this.
Well, it had a binodal distribution. There were the local people for whom the university was created, and the local GE here, General Electric, almost every employee promised to give a certain percentage of his salary for the first 2 years of the university.
Oh, okay.
Now, it may have been 25 cents a week, because this was 1963,
yeah.
You see.
Yeah.
That's $13 per person.
Yeah.
It all mounts up. And they were all interested in Trent. Uh-huh. They wanted it to succeed. And so the response of the workers from GE was really quite extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very good. So we had people locally. We also had some Champlain scholarships. I think three or four of Champlain, you see, was a French explorer who had gone through this valley about almost 600 years ago,
mm-hmm.
1500 and something. So we had some of those, and then we had a few other scholarships, and a few came just because they were curious.
Uh-huh.
Lord, this is going to be really good fun. Just 100 students and 20 professors, It's let's try it. You're not going to lose from an experience like that.
Yeah.
We got this Barbara Finlayson from Ottawa. She was the student who came in, was the highest standing of any student at that time, and it remained so for many years, if not still. And she maintained this Champlain scholarship for 4 years, and she went out. And I was talking by email yesterday with her on the arrangements for her to pay back. Her husband has just died, and she is now approaching retirement age, and she wants to make arrangements for paying back a large part of that. And would that be good? So I was arguing that, and I think this is true, that if you have scholarships for good students, the good students benefit from the financial support. They come to the university, and the average to less than average students benefit from their presence. If you took away the top 20% academic of your students, you'd have a very different student body. And the students meet with these good students in lectures, tutorials, seminars, and residence, on the bus, wherever. Yeah. And they know that it's possible for someone their age to work at and perform at a much higher level. Yeah. Yeah. And it's inspiring. A university that doesn't have a fourth year can't hope to be as good as one that does, because the fourth year gets into research, and then if you really want your research year to be good, you've got to have a master's program above it, so that those people see what people are doing when they're full-time at research rather than just doing one or two course credits for research.
So
we had this group that were attracted because of curiosity and scholarships and recommendations from their counselors, perhaps. This is what... So they came to us from Africa, Bermuda, Ottawa, India, there's one, Germany. It's from a number of countries. We had quite an international gathering. And there's 103, I think, or 104 students.
At the beginning?
At the first year, yes.
Now, what is the student body?
Students just over 8,000.
Okay.
We have 44,000 alumni now.
Okay. And so, originally, you probably didn't start granting graduate degrees until a while.
64, 65, 66, 67. That was a three-year degree.
Okay.
And then 68 was the first honors degree.
Okay.
And we also had one or two PhDs for students who had come with faculty members from other universities.
Okay. So it was a building up process over a period of a decade to get to where you felt like you had a really proper running university with regard to class sizes and programs and everything else.
Yes. And Senate, practicing Senate and the Faculty Association, rules, eventually a union, to get the place organized. Otherwise, you'll find somebody will come in and try to run it as though their grandfather had owned it. That's the worst.
Yeah.
And when we had a union, people regretted the necessity to have a union. We formed a union because one of the presidents went back on his word. He had agreed about something and went back on it, said, "I can't do that." So the union came in, and it has been much fairer. If you have rules and procedures and agreements to which you have to keep, rather than the oddities and inequities of individual decisions and so on, it makes for a much better organization. Yes.
So you have you're trying to get a research program going.
Yes.
And you started at Trent in
1965.
So according to my notes here, you didn't publish a whole lot in that early period until you started getting interested in...
My PhD thesis essentially was published, I think, 63. Mm-hmm. That was in the Royal Society with Polanyi. And then I did... using the facilities at York University, because I knew several of the people there. I traveled from Peterborough to York and did some work there.
York outside of Toronto.
Just outside Toronto. And I got an old pumping apparatus and did some experiments at at Trent here on Lifetimes of Excited Species in the Atmosphere. And then eventually got through to the first sabbatical.
Ah, okay.
Then started heating with gas.
Competing with?
Heating with gas.
Ah, okay. Yes. I just might be interested in looking at that chart. I'm just kind of trying to get number of pubs against time.
Ah, yes.
So you can see how it kind of swings. Starts out kind of slow, but then it gets going under full gear. And about the time you started getting into the mass spec side of things.
Yes.
So really, I mean, your early part of your career, mass spec was not part of your experience at the very early part.
No.
It was late. It wasn't until the ion trap things came along.
No, it wasn't until 1972, 73 in here that I went to France and learned about magnetic and electrostatic sectors.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
That was what France was. That was a sabbatical?
Or? Yes. And then at the end of that sabbatical, at the beginning, I read about the ion trap in chemistry in Britain and realized it was Todd. And there's a photograph taken, I think, in 1955, outside the chemistry department, and Todd and I are in that.
Okay. So you ran into him again.
And 55, that's 59 years ago.
Yeah.
Yes. So that was when I went to learn mass spectrometry, and then the ion trap, and came back, then built an ion trap apparatus, and then we took off through this period of about 76 to 77 through here. And then this was quite good, and this was very nice. This is when Varian got involved, and then I retired in 1999.
Didn't look like it in the graph, but...
No.
So I have a question, though. Why did you decide on a sabbatical you had a choice of places to go?
Can you just reach that for me, just to put it on the... That bound book. That's it.
I don't know if I can carry it over there.
That's up to 98.
Okay.
This was prepared for, in order to support a petition for a Doctor of Science at Leeds. Okay, so that takes us up to here, and I think there are 17. I think there are 17 publications after that.
Mm-hmm.
That no. There's more than that. Something like 77 after that. I'm not too sure. Anyway, it's not important now. So, what was your question?
Why did you decide? You have to select some place to go.
Ah, yes, yes.
What was the motivating factor to go to this place where you learned about mass spec?
Mm-hmm. I was very touched when we were opening or laying the cornerstone for a major college at Trent.
Okay.
The campus was just empty. I mean, it's just fields. And we laid the cornerstone. We had two premiers, Premier Robarts from Ontario and Premier Jean Lesage from Quebec.
Robarts,
R-O-B-A-R-T-S, John Robarts, Premier.
And
Jean, J-E-J-E-A-N. And Lesage, L-E-S-A-G-E.
They were there for this event?
For the laying of the cornerstone of Champlain College. Champlain, of course, was the great French explorer, and this was in Ontario, but we had to have both premiers there. And so I'm sure Robarts gave a rousing talk, and inspirational, etc., except I can't honestly remember a single word of it. He was a fine fellow, a fine premier, conservative. And I just can't remember a word. Jean Lesage was just delighted to be there. Mm-hmm. He was in Quebec and difficult to get out. If you were too friendly with the English, that was a stroke against you.
Mm-hmm. It's like being too friendly with Obama.
It's like being too, exactly. Yes. Your Obama is our French-Canadian. Where our situation is worse because it's more difficult to distinguish until they open their mouth. But he said that he was glad to be here. And he said, here in English Canada, he said, when I come to English Canada, people often ask me, Jean, what is it that you French guys want? And he said, do you know what I say? I reply, what is it that you English guys don't want us to have? And of course, that's summed up, the referendum in Scotland, everywhere where there is disharmony and you can't get an agreement.
Yeah.
What do they want? What are we not willing to give them?
Yeah.
Yes. Not willing to give equality. Yeah. This, that, and the other. Yeah. Very good. And so that meant that I should really pay more attention. I had lived in a French town, Montreal. And so I thought I'd go back and learn a little more of the basic French, mm-hmm. not just the language, but the understanding of the people. And I would try to go to France. And I knew that Orsay was very good. It's part of the Université de Paris Sud. That's at the south end of Paris. It's Orsay. And there was someone in doing mass spectrometry. The French weren't so interested in the technique. They were doing ion-neutral interactions.
Okay.
They referred to the physics or the chemistry, mm-hmm. not the interactions.
So you decided then to go to Orsay?
Orsay, yes.
And how long was that for?
A year.
Oh, okay. That gives you a chance to do something.
Yes.
And that's where mass spectrometry became, where you really got your first serious exposure to that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. To ionization, to the control of trajectories, to mass resolution. Different types of mass-selecting devices, detectors, and the understanding of what's happening from all the signals, signal averaging, all of these mm-hmm. techniques that are so necessary for a really very, very simple reaction. I can tell you, very simple. Let's take H+, that's a hydrogen atom.
Uh-huh.
My grandchildren all know what a proton is.
Oh, really?
Yes, because I tell them the story of the hydrogen atom that was crying in the street in Peterborough, downtown, just near where we were for lunch. And another hydrogen atom came along and said, goodness gracious, my friend, what on earth's the matter? And he said, I've lost an electron. And the second hydrogen atom said, well, are you sure? Oh, I'm positive. He's positive. Yes, now the grandchildren now all like that.
And if they all know what
a proton is. Yes, sir. Protons are very important.
I have to remember that.
Well, you try changing a proton, a deuterium, a deuteron for a proton, and your life will stop.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Heavy water is not will not support life as does ordinary water.
Ah, yes.
If I kept feeding you with heavy water for a week, you would die.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Just for a week?
As long as I do a substantial replacement of the thing. Yes, it's because the energy of... Well, they can tunnel. Protons can tunnel through the activation barrier, and deuterons may not.
Ah.
Hmm. Yes.
So a lot of chemistry is going to be halted.
Yeah, a lot of... Yes. Goldfish will die in about 35% heavy water.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
I have to tell my granddaughter that.
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, this was H plus, let's say, A2.
Okay.
H plus A2. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think can happen here? Well, the one of real interest is for this to go to H minus. And this, of course, being A2 and losing two electrons, to go to A2 plus.
Okay.
So, doing an actual case, H plus plus N2 gives H minus plus N2 double plus. And then excited.
Oh, okay.
So you can then examine, this is electronically excited, and so this will drop down to 2 plus star prime. Because it's not an infrared, it's not a vibrational quantum, mm-hmm. so it is allowed. And you can then tell the states, the doubly charged states of these of ions, and then that can fit in with CO double plus and O2 double plus and NO double plus and so on. So you look at a whole number of product ions which have the same electron content.
Okay.
So that was the so it was called double charge transfer.
And this was what you were going to study when you went to Orsay.
That's what I was studying at Orsay. Yes. Okay. With Durup and his group.
Okay. How do you spell his name?
D U R U P. Jean Durup. D U R U P.
And so they, who funded this trip for a year abroad?
It was the last year of a very good scheme. That is, if an academic went on sabbatical leave and stayed away from Canada for 366 days, they would not pay income tax for income drawn during that period.
Leave the country and not have to pay tax.
Had to be an academic, mm-hmm. leave the country for that period continuously, and could be paid their normal salary, but they would not pay any income tax for that period. The tax excused would help pay for the voyage and expenses and so on of taking a family. Mm-hmm. It was the last year.
It was promoting people to leave the country.
Yes. It was promoting, well, to go abroad and get knowledge and come back.
Yeah.
So they said they were going to wipe it out at the end of 72.
Mm-hmm.
So the university paid me twice as much for the second half of 72.
Oh, right.
So I got my full year's salary during that period and didn't pay tax on it.
Mm.
Well, and then the scheme died.
Yeah.
So now the poor souls have got... Hello, excuse me.
I'm leaving. Chiropractor, really.
Ah, oui, yes.
Okay, see you when I get back.
Okay.
So they pulled the plug on that deal. That's
yes,
the,
it was a it had a positive objective, and I don't think it could be abused because people had to get leave,
mm-hmm.
Permission to leave. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been paid the salary.
Yeah.
So it had to be a university-approved leave to wherever they were going and what they were going to do, because you've always got to write an application.
This,
there's a system whereby you get a sabbatical leave, but it's not automatic. You have to justify that.
Yeah.
So I thought it was short-sightedness.
But you were able to take advantage of it.
Yes. And so went to France, and this was a good thing to do, and that's what we did.
And so, your mass spec experience started with that whole leave.
Yes, but I had known a little about mass spec because during my graduate work at U of T, I had sent some samples to Fred Lossing. Fred Lossing was, John Holmes would tell you about Fred Lossing.
Mm-hmm.
He's the father of mass spectrometry in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Although actually I think the fellow at McMaster was probably older. So he had some samples, so I had to discuss those. And then, of course, the 2 years before I left Toronto, Alex Harrison arrived as a new professor.
Yeah.
And Alex is quiet, but nevertheless, I learned something. And then later in 1980s, you know, we got together, he and I and Bob Boyd, and got money for a ZAB-Q.
Okay.
The first ZAB-Q to be made.
Mm.
A ZAB-Q was a reverse geometry instrument with a quadrupole at the end.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So it was a B, E, Q, Q. Q, Q.
Yes.
Like that. 8,000 volts.
Oh, okay. You had to slow those puppies down before you send them to Q.
Ah, that was the challenge that Waters wanted to work on. Yes. So we got a reconditioned ZAB with a new QQ added onto it.
Okay.
Yes.
So there were two Qs at the end.
One was a quadrupole collision cell. And the other is the quadrupole mass filter. Yes.
So that was after you came back from France?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that was 10 years later.
And that machine was placed where?
Toronto.
Toronto,
yes.
Okay. But you helped get money for it?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Bob Boyd at Guelph, myself at Trent, and Alex were all applicants on the proposal.
And you got time on the instrument when
yes.
it was installed?
Okay. Yes.
So you had to go over to Toronto to use it?
Yes. But Alex was a splendid fellow.
Mm-hmm.
Always helpful. Always seem to have time to help.
Good. Okay, so let's see. You've now, this would have been how many, 5 years after you had started at Trent?
So I'm now into the end of the sabbatical. I came with a short visit to Canterbury at the end of my sabbatical, and that would bring me to the end of 8 years at Trent.
Okay. And you're pretty well established. You're still teaching, though, right?
Oh, yes.
And but you've got a research group going.
Yes.
And they're studying what?
Building the quadrupole ion trap.
Okay. So
and electronics.
Why did you get into the trap? I mean, there's a lot of people picked up on the linear quads and what was going on with them, but you got interested in the trap.
Well, I had a linear quad, and we were doing some work with a Waters, first of all, 100, and then a 400 QXK, something like that. The 100 range and the 400 mass range. And we were able to do some work with that, but we were building the ion trap, and we didn't know how to get the ions out mass selectively or to measure the mass-to-charge ratio, so we ejected them into a quadrupole mass filter. So we had a Quista quad operation, and we had to build the power supplies and get it all together. We had a big oscilloscope with four channels because...
So the quad was just transporting the ions away. The Quista was doing the mass separation.
It was doing the storage and manipulation of the trajectories, yes.
Okay.
And then we could eject them all together. We could eject them with frequencies, but we did little of that. They would eject them as a group, and they would be filtered by the quadrupole mass filter.
Okay.
So this was repetitive of filling, ejection, and the... The quadrupole mass filter would be moved along, so it was slowly scanning the mass spectrum.
Okay, in the linear quad.
Yes.
All right. So the trap was just a storage, a place to store ions and play with them in a storage.
That's right. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Of course, when I first saw it, I thought it's like a test tube.
Yeah.
With you know, 1 cubic centimeter in the bottom of the test tube, and we had done, you know, tests with analytical chemistry, was test tube chemistry when I went to university in school. all sorts of colors and fizzes and precipitates, mm-hmm. Whether it be barium sulfate or silver chloride, whatever, or nickel, nickel dimethyl glyoxime. A beautiful pink precipitate, quite characteristic. So here we had the iron trap volume, but no solvent. Mm-hmm. We could add solvent molecules if we wished, or not. We could study the ions themselves. Not hydrated, not complex, just the straight ions, and we could, as we discovered, begin to affect their trajectories. We could focus them all in by putting in a little background gas and get to a cloud. Mm-hmm. We could then pass a laser through there if we wanted, or we could then play the organ with about 10 frequencies, you see, and 10 species would start moving outwards. Or just one species would move outwards with one frequency. We could move the we could eject one species, and see how the others change. We could eject one and then see at what frequency the next one went out, or we could reverse that and see if the density, that is the space charge, had any influence on the frequency at which the ions were ejected. Of course, it did. Mm-hmm. There are effects of space charge, and so
we
So there are lots of, and we could try to find out where are the ions in the trap, and if you haven't focused them at the center, how are they distributed in the trap?
So it's just really understanding everything that was going on with respect to the quadrupole ion trap.
That's right. And I had one fellow who was really very good. He would do experiments, and it would tell him something, and we would argue about it and discuss it. And that was a fellow called John Fulford, and I'm sure you've never heard of him.
No.
No.
How do you spell it?
F-U-L-F-O-R-D.
Okay. So, what happened to John?
He left me. He graduated from Trent. And he left. He wasn't in, didn't do a research project with me. Did a research project with a colleague. So I didn't see him. So I thought, oh, John's gone. I don't know what he's doing. I wrote him a letter. These are the days you write a letter.
Yeah.
He's down at the lakeshore, 30 miles away. I wrote him a letter. Lord, reply came back. And I said, let me know what you're doing. If you're not doing, come up and I'll show you what we are doing in our lab and see if we can interest you what doing. Yes, I'll come up, and I'm not doing anything. Can I come and see your lab? Yeah. So he came up, and he did a master's with me. So he did this work, mm-hmm. and then he left me and went with SciEx.
Oh, okay.
And then, just a few weeks after this, there was what we call the Mississauga disaster, and there was a train derailment just north of Toronto. There was styrene and chlorine released, and they started to react. 250,000 people were evacuated from Mississauga. It was a day a bit like today, clear blue skies with a north wind blowing. Fortunately, the wind blew it straight over Mississauga and into the Ontario, Lake Ontario. And John was with two other guys in a converted house trailer driving around Mississauga, totally deserted apart from some soldiers, using a quadrupole mass filter to try to analyze what's happening, what's up there, and what's happening to it. So that was the training he had, and with masks on, of course. That was the training that he had in my laboratory for that. He retired last year, vice president. He did a lot of work on the ELAN, the E-L-A-N type of ion cyclotron resonance instrument. No, the ion inductive bicoupled plasma, ICP.
Oh,
for metals, yes, the ELAN.
What does that stand for? ELAN?
That was the name of the instrument. It was elemental analysis, you see, for ICP. But this was, so the value of this training, that he really became very competent, very confident, and remained a productive fellow. Never got a PhD and never felt the lack of it. No. He was bright. One of his colleagues was a chap called Ron Bonner, and Ron Bonner had a PhD. He was also a vice president at the same time. Ron Bonner was a student when I went to Canterbury in 1973, at the end of my sabbatical. Then Ron came back to Trent a couple of years later when he finished his degree and worked here, and then went to the Ministry of Environment, then went to Rockefeller University with Frank Field, and of course Brian Chait. And Frank Field and Brian, they used to send me their electron multipliers when the sensitivity had dropped down about 10^6. They sent them to me.
Great.
Because I couldn't afford to buy anymore. And tremendous amount of cooperation from them. But that was Dr. Ron Bonner. And he, as I say, was... retired last year also, and we're still collaborating with Ron. We have a project now on the emerald ash borer, and we are using principal component analysis, and Ron has quite some experience in this area, and so he's collaborating with us. So I've known Ron for a little over 40 years, 42 years.
Uh-huh. Oh, my type skills are getting down here, okay. So this takes care of having gone abroad and coming back to Trent, and now you're really into the iron trap.
Yes.
And so that's been a theme pretty much since then until now, is the iron trap.
That was 73, 74 when we got it going. There was the time in the middle 80s when we had the ZAB-Q at Toronto. Worked on that with a number of students. And then that would take us up to about 1991. And that's when Varian, of course, there was the commercialization of the iron trap.
Yeah.
I had another student... gosh, I have a picture of this. This is not a very good photograph. Mel Commissaro, does that name mean anything to you?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, Mel, yeah. He was here?
Only for a brief visit.
Uh-huh.
Mel Commissaro, and who is the big, I've forgotten the name, the big fellow that runs the NMR at Tallahassee.
Oh.
What's his name?
You're not talking to Highfield.
Yes.
But that's the mass spec?
Yes. Marshall.
Yeah,
yes.
Marshall. Yeah.
Marshall and Commissaro did the first Fourier transform of an ICR mass spectrum and from frequency and produced it as a function of mass to charge ratio.
Uh-huh.
They did it by hand. and that is Mel Commissaro.
Oh, okay.
This was an early conference at Trent called the Trent Conferences, which still goes. I think it's continued since 1977 to the present day. And you can't see, this is a very poor print, but this face here, that's John Fulford, and this is a young girl called Alison McClellan, as she was before she married. And they were here at the same time. Ron Bonn had his parents here, and so he wasn't at the conference. But this is Trent University. So, this...
Thomas Fowl and Marshall did this experiment here?
No, at UBC.
UBC.
Yes.
Okay. That would have been 1970.
When they did it?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Could you pass me the bottom book, and I can perhaps look it up.
See, which one's the one at the bottom?
Just the bottom, yes, I'm sorry. Just push the others off. Yes. Thank you. Let me just see if I... Oh, yes. It's going to take too much time to go through. I don't have the file here. I don't have the file. What is this?
Well, I'm sure
no.
It's easy enough to find in a...
Yes, yes, yes. Commissaro and Marshal, or Marshal and Commissaro. Anyway, the girl wanted to do, this is Alison McLellan, and her father still lives just up here, and she still teaches in Peterborough, and she's now Alison Armitage, has four children. I said, Alison, what I'd like to do is we have this GC here. I'd like you to, we can do with the ion trap electron impact mass spectrum, and we can also delay things so that we get a chemical ionization mass spectrum, one very rapidly after the other. And what I'd like to do is to use this gas chromatograph and to put in some simple compounds and see how they come out. And the target is to put in, say, four compounds and obtain the EI and CI mass spectra of each of those four compounds, separated mm-hmm. in time.
Mm-hmm.
That was her thesis problem. So she did it, and I took it to Seattle, and I showed it. And I also had one of an ion trap, like one of those, in my pocket, okay. mm-hmm. which Burnaby Munson found me showing to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
He was furious.
Yes, yes, yes.
You can understand why. Yes, not supposed to do it. I said, well, it's my whole mass spectrometer. You see, I put it in my pocket. Can you do that with yours? Anyway, along came Paul Kelly and George...
K-E-L-L-E-Y,
okay. as he corrected me, and George Stafford.
Oh, okay.
George Stafford Jr. And they said, well, that's really pretty, doing the EI and the CI mass spectra, and you've separated those. But the way you're measuring the mass spectra with a quarter-pole mass filter, that's I mean, the ion trap is great, and it's you need it, but there's got to be a better way of doing it.
Uh-huh.
So this was 1979, and they went off, and of course in 1983 announced in Washington that they had discovered the ion trap detector,
mm-hmm.
which was a gas chromatograph, an ion trap, a quarter pole ion trap, a computer, and a new way of sending the ions out. It was axially, the axial, oh dear, I've forgotten the phrase. What they did was they brought the ions essentially close to the center and then increased the voltage on the device, and that moves everything to the right-hand side of the all of the ions are here, where this is a little one, that's one, this is two, this is three, this is four, and this is five. And so if you increase the RF voltage then they will all move to the right in this diagram, and at this point they will leave, and they happen to leave with a lot of axial energy. Mm-hmm. This is on the axis of the trap. They leave with high axial energy, and they will go and hit a detector. Mm-hmm. No problem. And so all they had to do was to ramp the RF voltage, and the ions would come out and generate a mass spectrum.
Sure.
Axial something. I've forgotten. Anyway, that was it. So they, with a computer, of course, they're able to do the whole thing, handle the data, because you get lots of data.
Yeah.
And that was the ITD. And then there was the ITMS, the commercial one, which they did more clever things with frequencies. When they sold the ITD, they sold it with DC power supplies.
Okay.
Which were never used. Because the ions, the working points of the ions and the ITD always stayed on the Q-axis.
Okay.
And to get off this way or that way, this required negative DC, and this required positive DC. So when I became the research lab for Varian, we had these, and so we began to explore. And so we could move ions up to here and up to there and down to here and get to the boundary, and then we have a patent for that and so on. So all sorts of things you could do. But it came quite a powerful little instrument.
Yeah, was very compact.
Oh, very compact, yes. Not much bigger than twice the size of that little cabinet there with the things in.
There's one point that I have noticed here, and we're talking about quadrupoles, and we mentioned GE, and so I thought, were you aware that GE once commercially sold a monopole?
Sorry, did?
GE once had a commercial product called a monopole.
A monopole, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. They went with that for a few years, and I guess they figured out the market wasn't going to work out.
No, it wasn't very good. Had a very limited range.
Yeah.
Yes.
I always wondered how the ions, I guess, I can understand how the ions, well, what's going on inside a quad, but where it seems about the quadrupole, with a monopole, we're going to limit your ability to get them. That's kind of, I mean, you're reflecting the fields, but the ions are going to run into the reflector.
Yes, the monopole was something like...
like an L-shaped thing with a one single quad or single rod.
Like this, with a single rod in here. Yes. And this was at a certain voltage or varied voltage. What you had to do was to aim. You couldn't admit the ions here. You had to aim the ions over here. And so they were bent round and then came out over here. They did a little. No, they didn't. They didn't do it because this was. It was a monopole, but I don't think there was any RF associated with it.
Oh, really?
It was all DC. I may be wrong, but I don't remember seeing anything with this type of trajectory.
Yeah.
But there may have been.
Interesting. Yeah, another idea that many that didn't fly after the fact. After all. So you really are into traps now. It's kind of your primary research topic.
Yes. Now, once I retired, I really finished with the iron trap instruments that I had, because the Water Quality Center started. I was instrumental in starting the Water Quality Center at Trent.
Okay.
We'd started with the Trent University Institute of Mass Spectrometry, 2IMS. 2IMS, Trent University Institute for Mass Spectrometry. And then shortly after that, perhaps 3 years after that, CFI started, this Canadian Foundation for Innovation. Mm-hmm. And CFI would give you 40% of the price of a new instrument. And the Ontario government agreed it would also give 40%. So the university, or the recipients, had to find 20%. And that has continued. Mm-hmm. So with the water quality, with that program, this was too vague a title. Uh-huh. So we then set up the Water Quality Center, talking of all aspects of water, both the purification of water systems for towns and villages, water disinfection, soil water handling, and also future problems of mercury in water, heavy metals in water, arsenic in water, sulfur in water, now nanoparticles. Mm-hmm. A lot of flavonoids, for example, make up 2% of all the organic growth each year.
Really?
And yes, and leaves and things, when they decompose, flavonoids get into the water. So I started out looking at flavonoids, mass spec and NMR, flavonoids and the glycosides, some work on antibiotics. The antibiotics was interesting because that really led to some work on mad cow disease. Hmm. And Keith Jennings was quite heavily involved with chasing prions. Mm-hmm. In connection with mad cow disease in Britain. Mm. And they found that feeding cows, parts of cows, was not a good idea.
Yes. Prions. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I guess that's accepted science. I think for a while the whole idea of these tangled structures was kind of not accepted by the community for some time, if I recall correctly.
Yes, yes.
The guy that came up with them was ridiculed for some time. It's basically a misfolding of proteins, right? Mm. The proteins are there, they just don't fold up the way they're supposed to.
Yes.
Yes.
And that led to the rise of ion mobility spectrometry.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yes.
And ion mobility spectrometry is something like spectrometry, but at a higher pressure. Mass spectrometry, but at a higher pressure. Mm-hmm. And with a counter-directional DC pulse.
I'm sorry?
With an antagonistic DC pulse going through. So we have some electrodes with a hole in, and the ions could be fed through in a stream, but you could have a positive pulse being applied to each of the electrodes in turn. You get a traveling wave. Mm-hmm. and that's the basis of the ion mobility spectrometer. At least this is the synergy. No, what's it called? That's the other one. Synergy. What's the new instrument called? This FAMES. FAMES is one, yes. That was discovered in Ontario.
Oh, really?
It's very sad, this one. It's really progressed, but the person who developed it and pushed it initially was a great enthusiast of riding motorbikes. Mm. And I think he had just reached an agreement with, I think it was Thermo, to take over this. Then he had an accident on his motorbike, and he's been crippled ever since. Mm. I've seen him once in a wheelchair since that time.
What's his name?
I don't know. It's French. I don't know.
That's sad.
Very, very sad. He lives just outside Ottawa now in a house which can get his wheelchair all around. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But this other one...
And the mobility thing that you're trying to think of?
This other mobility thing. Can you pass me volume 4? Which may be the bottom one again. I think I put those starting from the top. Yes.
That's 5.
Oh, it's 5. This is 4 at the bottom. Okay, this is the one I want. Scrivens.
Oh, yeah.
You know Jim Scrivens?
Yes, I know Jim.
Somebody's stolen it. Synapt instrument. Mike Bowers is big on the Synapt instrument. Looking at...
Is that an acronym or...?
No, it's not.
Synapt.
This is not an obvious one. For Alzheimer's.
Oh, really?
Yes, because it gives you some information on
the shape
and the volume. Yes. Now, one of the Synapt did one very interesting thing, and that if you talk to chemists about proteins and existing in charged states, we talk about native proteins,
yes,
in the native conformation, mm-hmm, as they might exist at physiological pH, and they're protonated, and we think that's the way, and they have particular shapes. Putting them through the synapt, begin to find that for some charge states, there are two times of arrival.
That suggests
two different forms.
Folding.
Yes, two different folding processes. Yes. And that, I think, is really quite fascinating.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, and that's all because of the ability to see the shape information.
Yes.
Or distinguish between shapes.
Yes. They're both exactly the same mass to charge ratio, but different shapes. And it's interesting because I was doing an experiment once, adding something to a protein, and we could never get the protein to be fully reacted. Now, Le Chatelier tells you if you have something precious and you want to make a compound from it, you add lots of the other stuff. Mm-hmm. So you drive the equilibrium to the right. Mm-hmm. I could never drive it exhaustively to the right. And an explanation for that would be there are two structures, one of which doesn't add on a particular ligand. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So at the end of this came the Water Quality Center with some new instruments. This would be a triple stage quadrupole with a 4,000 mass range, a QTOF, and then into linear traps. Linear traps, and I missed two things in my life. I missed the... I tell people this because it makes a bigger impression than just saying these exist. I didn't see how obvious electrospray was, even though as a youngster I used to play with my mother's... perfume spray with a little balloon, and I could do this, and I could see the mist. Mm-hmm. of droplets. I mean, it was all there. All I had to do was to say, I should put in some heated nitrogen, and then the ions would be free from this thing. You see, missed that last point. Mm-hmm. Fenn beat me to it. And the other thing is that I played for quadrupoles for years, never thought of putting a DC plate at each end. Man, I missed the boat. They're that simple. So we have a 5500 in the lab, which is very nice. Cyex linear trap instrument, the most sensitive we have. So I've become more interested in, gone from flavonoids, so antibiotics, and now working with proteins and insect-induced metabolite changes. But adding the adding ligands to the protein, we know that drugs are carried by proteins. What happens if we take a perfluorinated substance, one which I use to keep this? See this beautiful crease on my trousers. And that's partly there with a surfactant. And they're kept clean, despite the attempts of my grandchildren to mess up, because they're treated with this surfactant. And so are the carpets and, and drapes, if we had drapes. And this of course, is a perfluorooctanoic acid, or sulfonic acid was the other one. And every American... Every American has these in his blood now, or her blood.
Stuff in his body.
Yes. Everybody. Even the deer up in the Arctic. Not the deer, the bears in the Arctic have this. And so if we have a protein and we adhere a drug to it, and then we add some of this PFOS, the perfluorooctanoic sulfonic acid, it will displace the drugs.
Okay. So that would be a good thing, right?
That's a bad thing.
It's a bad thing.
A bad thing. If you have something in your blood which is preventing your drugs from reaching the site to which they're intended, then that's a bad thing.
Okay, I was thinking it was a way to chase away bad drugs. But
We're thinking of good drugs here, yes.
Okay. That's not a good thing.
You should keep bad drugs out of your system voluntarily.
Some people do adopt, Yeah, that seems to be something of a sleeping giant problem, this PFOS, the perfluorooctanoic acid thing.
Yes, yes. 3M have stopped making PFOS voluntarily.
Yeah.
They saw the evidence and they volunteered to stop. That, unfortunately, doesn't stop countries like China and India and the Philippines making it. But I don't think you can even buy it in the States now. And it's very difficult to buy in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And that's in small amounts for laboratory use. It's difficult.
Well, we're learning about stuff. Much after the fact. I mean, we've got the whole business with the chlorinated insecticides and the polychlorinated biphenyls and all these other compounds that looked like they were okay, or at least people didn't think about how bad they could be.
Yes.
Have come into play. I noticed that you had a publication on quite a lengthy discussion of the PCBs.
Yes. PCBs and dioxins and furans. We developed for Varian a tandem mass spectrometric analysis of PCBs. Well, dioxins and furans initially, and then later PCBs.
I don't know. They've been distributed throughout the environment in containers for the most part. But sooner or later, those containers are going to come down. And I guess there's a plan for disposing of those containers in their insides, because the amount that's contained is very, very much larger than the amount that's out in the environment right now. I would assume by orders of magnitude, maybe even. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But I guess people are more careful about what they create and put in the environment today than they were 50 years ago.
Oh yes, Love Canal near Niagara was a great problem. I remember seeing in Scientific American an article about the Great Lakes, and then they showed analysis of semen. Human semen, from people in various towns around the Great Lakes. A tremendous amount of chlorinated compounds, principally chlorinated, some brominated, but principally at that time, chlorinated. The brominated, that is the anti-fire problems, didn't really come until a little later. But the chlorinated ones were there, and I went to a talk at a university in Oshawa. You came through Oshawa. There's a new university there. And I went to this lecture of a fellow called Geisy, G-E-I-S-Y. I had to go and see. He's got something like 960 publications. And so we got along very well. I met him before the talk. And I asked him at the end of his talk if he thought that these halogenated compounds, which have arisen in the last 50, 60, 70 years, does he think they are at all responsible for autism, diabetes, and or obesity? He dodged the question.
Uh-huh. Well, it takes a fairly massive study to, get to the bottom of that, and you can't really. If you think it's going to harm your population, that's not an ethical thing to do. So it's a problem.
Yes. Do you know autism now is about as common as carbon-13?
Oh, really?
Yes.
About 11%.
1.1%. Yes.
1.1%.
Yes. 1 in 83. Mm-hmm. Children are autistic these days in Ontario. And an autistic child, very, very few of them can look after themselves or hold a job. And once they get to 20, they have to be put into public accommodation. Mm-hmm. With my daughter, our youngest daughter, there's a picture somewhere. Oh, youngest daughter there, is in charge of the Kelly's Place Autism Services for Ontario, and she has several hundred houses, each of which holds a few, and with the staff to look after them, and the government pays her company to do that. Tremendous cost.
Yes.
Obesity. On TV, you can see some extraordinary pictures. Canadian and American TV, and that's getting worse throughout the world. See, in China, too. And diabetes, they tell me, is of course very common among older people, but it's also becoming more common. So, we have some problems. So there's lots of work to be done.
So when did you get the Water Quality Center started?
About 1997.
Okay, so when did you officially retire?
1999.
So yes. Shortly after.
Yes.
And what was the motivation for this Water Quality Center?
Well, it was to provide a much more appealing title for our proposals for instrumental money.
So it had a hook.
It had a hook, yes, yes. We had to show that there was, that we worked together. It wasn't just for one person or two people. It was a community or a university thing which was available to people at other universities, and it's still so. And that there was some common theme to the work, so that it would be supportive of the workers, yes.
And that's supported by the province?
The province and the federal government. Federal government is the CFI, that's the Canadian part. And then Ontario is Ontario's Research and Technology program, which funds 40% also.
I see. So it's a joint funding activity.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So we've just taken delivery of an Orbitrap.
Oh, wow.
A Q-Exacta Orbitrap and a Maldi source. Which is very exciting, and we have a room being renovated now to accommodate the Brooker FTICR, which is coming, which has a resolution of around 10 million.
That's going to be with a Supercon magnet?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Getting harder and harder to keep those guys refrigerated.
Yes.
Helium is becoming...
Yes, helium is becoming a problem. Yes.
Very pricey proposition.
Yes. And we have a multi-sector instrument for the ICP people, the people who want to look at metals. So you can look at 7 isotopes of helium, of mercury at one time.
Oh, okay.
No, mercury isotopes go ta la 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 la. Well, you can look at all 7 and how they vary in biological processes.
I spent a lot of time with the Bendix time of flight mass spec with a mercury diffusion pump. So I'm very familiar with the mercury isotopes.
Yes.
But you're saying that there's a differentiation of the isotopes of mercury as a function of...
biological processes, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Hmm. That seems a bit strange to me.
No, it occurs. The explanation... the most common explanation that I've heard is that the variation in the zero-point energy when mercury is reacting with something, it's always a situation of... mercury. Let's say this is mercury. Mercury, and this is A. And there will be a moment of inertia for these two, and there's a zero-point energy for this vibrator. So if we plot it like this, there's a moment, there's a zero-point energy here, and that will vary with the mass of the mercury. Now, it's very small.
Yes, it's very small.
But over by, we know, for example, if I were doing the same thing for hydrogen, as isotope, there is hydrogen, there is hydrogen deuterium, here is deuterium. We won't bother with the tritium, but there is appreciable difference. Here, there's, this is, say, for mercury 202. I'm getting a little lost now. This is for 203. And I'm exaggerating the difference, but that is the most common explanation I have heard for the variation.
Yeah, well, it's Richard. The mass difference is small. That's
yes, well, it's 0.5%, but over 10,000 years.
What do you think about taking a break?
Yes.
And then we can maybe wrap up things after we push.